Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Smothers against McCautry. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, representing Gary McCautry, the warden in this case. The district court granted habeas in this case, and in my view, the biggest reason that the court was wrong is because Mr. Smothers can't demonstrate prejudice. And to understand why, I think we have to get into Wisconsin's law of imperfect self-defense. In Wisconsin, for a simple assault, self-defense is an absolute defense. But when the charge is first-degree intentional homicide, in addition to showing self-defense, the defendant must show two other things. In the language of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's most recent case on this, there are two hurdles. The first hurdle is self-defense. The second hurdle is that the defendant must demonstrate both that there was an imminent threat of death and that the amount of force used was reasonable. If the defendant succeeds in proving the first thing, self-defense, the first hurdle, but doesn't prove one of the second, first-degree intentional homicide is reduced to second-degree intentional homicide. In this case, the prosecutor's argument went solely to the first hurdle, self-defense. His argument was that Mr. Smothers made up the whole thing. It wasn't a matter of self-defense at all, and the jury should disbelieve him. The jury, however, convicted him of second-degree intentional homicide.
Mr. Weinstein, you're losing me.
I'm sorry.
We're not here to resolve any questions of state law. Only that question on the table has to do with the federal Constitution.
That's correct. And under
why don't we address the federal Constitution?
I'm sorry, I thought I was. If Mr.
You haven't mentioned it so far.
Well, okay. I'm sorry. The second prong of Strickland, ineffective assistance of counsel, is that Mr. Smothers must establish prejudice. And I think the reason he can't establish prejudice is that he succeeded in convincing the jury that he was acting in self-defense, and that was exactly what the prosecutor's argument, the alleged deficient performance, went to. The argument was, in essence, Mr. Smothers made up this whole thing. And the jury disbelieved that, did not go along with the prosecution. The jury believed Mr. Smothers was acting in self-defense. So it seems to me that even if the prosecutor's argument was, or the failure to object to the prosecutor's argument was deficient performance, there still was no prejudice because in the end the jury believed, despite the improper argument. So in my view, that's the prong of the Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel claim that Mr. Smothers can't establish prejudice. And without that, he can't succeed on federal habeas. I hope that clears it up. In terms of the deficient performance itself,
this is an argument you're making that was never addressed by the state court, I take it.
No, the state court did address prejudice.
Did address prejudice?
Yes, it addressed both deficient performance and prejudice. Although it did it in a very summary manner.
So your So the statement in your brief that the decision is entitled to deference even though the Wisconsin Court of Appeals did not address prejudice is wrong.
Oh,
that's a heading in your brief. There's one reason why I'm so confused.
I see. Well, maybe. I'm sorry. Let me check the headings. Yes, you're indeed correct. Well, the problem, I think, and the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin only addressed the matter, or primarily addressed the matter, involving the 911 call. And the 911 call was a pre-Miranda statement. And they just very briefly indicated that that a post 911 Miranda claim couldn't lie, and basically said for the same reason as the 911 call, the pre Miranda, which of course, if you do separate the comment out into post and pre Miranda, that analysis won't quite work, because
what analysis?
The pre-Miranda analysis, the pre-Miranda statement.
Right. Well, what the statement, I guess, is where you talk about it's a closing argument, right? I don't know what was done in cross-examination.
There was no cross-examination on it. The only...
Didn't he testify? Was there cross-examination?
There was cross-examination. Mr. Smothers did
testify. Why he just brought it up and all that, or not? Is this closing argument the only time he refers to the... a long time has passed since March 23rd. Since then, Mr. Smothers has been charged. He's come represented by Mr. Rose. He's had an opportunity to get and review the police reports, and now he's trying to make a statement. Is that the part that's...
That's the closing argument, yes.
Is that the issue that's... Isn't that the issue that's correct.
The 911 tape was introduced into evidence and played for the jury.
Right.
Aside from the actual 911 tape itself, there was no cross-examination on, as we see in many of the Doyle-type cases, why didn't you tell the police officer this when you were first arrested, or you didn't tell this to the officers when they interviewed you. There was none of that kind of cross-examination, nor did the state elicit any evidence about Mr. Smothers' arrest before the jury. There was no evidence. I did make a statement in my brief that there was no evidence in the record, and what I meant was there's no evidence in the trial record. As the appellee accurately points out, there is evidence in some of the earlier arraignment and other proceedings that he was arrested. But there was no evidence before the jury about his arrest. So the only matter that the only comment on his exercise of silence was in closing argument. There was no cross-examination on it at all. So that was the first time the state had ever said he never said anything earlier, or he exercised his silence earlier. Which he actually did in the 911 call. The 911 operator asked him who stabbed the victim, and Mr. Smothers said, "I don't want to make a statement." So he did actually exercise his right to silence at that point, but that was prior to his to any Miranda warning. There were no police even on the scene at that point. So,
the basis of the habeas is this statement, isn't it, that I just read?
That's correct. The district court broke it up into two separate claims. The first claim being that it was an improper comment on his exercise of silence at the time he actually did it in the 911 call. And the district court rejected that claim. But the district court also said, well, the comment itself here not only goes to the 911 call, it also encompasses the period after he was arrested when he surely got Miranda warnings, and he didn't make any statements in that period either, and that's a violation of Doyle. So his attorney was deficient for not objecting to that part of the argument because of the, as the district court saw it, the comment on the post-Miranda silence. I frankly don't think, well, the first question, of course, is if the statement really goes to the post-Miranda silence at all, but it's difficult to break up a statement like that in oral argument, I think, and say, well, it's directed toward the 911 call, but really it also encompasses the post-Miranda silence, because if that's correct, it seems to me any time a defendant doesn't make a statement after arrest but makes one prior to arrest and the prosecutor makes a reference to it, it's going to necessarily encompass that period from post-arrest to trial. But the Supreme Court cases seem pretty clearly to say that if the defendant testifies, a pre-arrest or pre-Miranda statement is fair game for cross-examination. So it seems to me that that kind of parsing of the statements prior to, unless there's an actual reference to post-Miranda silence, that's a different story. But when the statement really is directed toward the pre-Miranda silence, then it seems to me that it's difficult to say, well, that's also a comment on post-Miranda
silence. It wasn't quite silence. He said something, then he said he didn't want to discuss it any further.
That's correct. In the pre-Miranda.
Yeah,
that's right. But that's, so long as the Miranda warnings haven't been given, that kind of a statement.
Well, wasn't in custody, so that doesn't.
No, he wasn't in custody. He came in from the
got
altercation.
Got on the telephone and talked to the lady who was in charge of the 911 call.
Right. He asked his neighbor to call. The neighbor said, "Person wants to talk to you," and he got on the phone and
the
started
dude
talking.
The dude out there that's been stabbed.
Yes. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Guest.
May it please the court, Jeremy Gaston for petitioner, appellee Robert J. Smothers. I'd first like to address what the state says is their strongest basis for reversal, which is the prejudice issue. I think it's very clear that the state's argument rests on a misconception that Smothers' testimony only established his actual belief in the situation being one where he needed to use self-defense. I think the proper analysis there is that when Smothers testified as to all the circumstances that led up to the fatal stab wound, he established both his actual belief that he needed to use lethal force to stop the attack, as well as an objective, reasonable situation, because his testimony was evidence of the circumstances, namely that a highly intoxicated person was choking him, was preventing him from retreating twice, was resisting three different forms of lesser force, including numerous lesser knife wounds that did not stop the attack. And so in that circumstance, Smothers' testimony demonstrated both his actual belief that he needed to use lethal force as well as circumstances that would lead any reasonable person to say we need to use lethal force to stop the attack because nothing else is working. So for that reason, the prosecutor's argument, which discredited his self-defense testimony, was prejudicial on both of those aspects, and in fact specifically referenced the fact that this is what the prosecutor said in closing. Smothers has carte blanche. He has carte blanche to say whatever he puts himself in the best position legally. The best position legally is that I was fighting for my life. I had nothing I can do. It was kill or be killed. And the fact that it was both in his mind kill or be killed and actually kill or be killed, given the circumstances, demonstrates the prejudice. And we also, incidentally, have a waiver argument because the state never made this prejudice argument to the district court, the federal district court, until after judgment had been entered. And so we would say they had waived their ability to challenge it on appeal. And in terms of whether the state court of appeals addressed prejudice, I would just point out that the state court of appeals, consistent with the state's brief, only addressed deficiency under Strickland. In fact, the concluding sentence in that opinion is, because trial counsel did not perform deficiently in any of the situations, Smothers' argument that relief is warranted based on the cumulative effect also fails, and that counsel was just in each of the cases not deficient for failing to object. So it never addressed prejudice, which is why this court reviews it de novo and not under the AEDPA standard of review. I would also point out it's a little incorrect to say there was no evidence about Smothers' arrest in the record, because Smothers himself testified that he was arrested, and we cited also the court to the place where it says that he was handcuffed and secured. And I think the more fundamental point is certainly the fact of Miranda warnings don't have to be before the jury in these cases.
They don't have to be before the jury, but they do have to be given. They're essential in Doyle.
That is correct. And that
9/11 call obviously was not custodial interrogation, and your client didn't get Miranda warnings.
Right.
So I don't see why this case isn't governed by Fletcher against Weir.
And the reason for that is, in terms of the post-Miranda issue, is he was Mirandized at arrest, and that is
there. He was given Miranda warnings.
He was given Miranda warnings after.
Mirandized is something like Sanferized.
Yes, he was given Miranda warnings after arrest, and we've provided the court the references to where that was shown.
And is there any doubt that Weir was given Miranda warnings after he was arrested?
Well, what the Supreme Court says, there is no evidence in the record that he was given Miranda warnings.
At the time of his statement, right? Surely Weir can't be distinguished on the ground that Miranda warnings were given at some intervening time. The inference that was involved in Weir was, you made a statement. Why didn't you tell us then what you're telling us now? The Supreme Court said that that didn't violate the Constitution, was a good inference. It's the very same line of argument taken here.
Well, except for the fact that the point...
We're supposed to follow what our bosses say.
Right, except for the fact that the argument was not just based on the time period prior to Miranda warnings, but it was also based on the time period after Miranda warnings. The evidence indicated that he was arrested March 23rd, 1996, and that he was given Miranda warnings that day. Now, the fact that he was given Miranda warnings was not before the jury, but it was a fact that demonstrates when the state's promise not to use his silence against him was given. So in closing, when the prosecutor says he knows that after 5 months, 5+ months, he can give a statement now, he can talk about the incident, it's a comment on both the prior silence and the post-Miranda silence. And unlike Weir, it's a place where you are referencing silence that is after Miranda warnings. There was no evidence that there was any silence after Miranda warnings that was being used in Weir. And that's why that case is distinguished, and that's why the district court was correct to find that the argument went...
He did testify, didn't he?
Yes, Smothers testified longer than any witness and testified as to the events. Yeah. In fact, he was the only surviving eyewitness to the events, which is why the attack on...
So the comment that he had a lot of time to prepare himself for the defense is not exactly off the wall, is it?
It's true that he had a long time to prepare himself, but the mistake the prosecutor made was, and I would just reference for an understanding of the Doyle line of cases, this circuit's decision in the Splunge v. Park case, which I note that both Judge Easterbrook and Judge two of the judges on this.
It does not matter who is on the panel
yep.
in any given case.
We're all stuck with each other.
Right. Well, the explanation is that any hint that the silence is inconsistent with the testimony imperils the verdict, and that's the understanding of...
That's assuming that he hadn't made an original statement when Miranda was not necessary, when he was a volunteer.
Well, right. His statement before Miranda does not implicate Doyle at all.
odd.
It's the fact of silence after he was given Miranda warnings that implicates Doyle.
It was, in effect, distaste from him taking himself out of the picture by saying there was a dude dying, but he didn't want to talk about it anymore.
A dude
has been stabbed. He's dying here, but I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Right. At that time, before Miranda...
He doesn't say he did it. He doesn't say he did it in self-defense. He just said that.
Right. And we separately point out that invoking of the right to remain silent was entitled to protection.
Wait. He didn't invoke his right to remain silent at that stage of the game. He just said, I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's not an invocation. That's just a statement.
Well, we would say that it is an invocation under both the Castigar case from the U.S. Supreme Court and this case, this circuit's decision.
Well, would that first portion of it still be available to the jury for the prosecution to present to the jury?
Before he...
So what difference does it make?
Well, the difference that it makes is that the state can't offer substantive evidence of...
Well, they didn't interrogate him after that.
No, the state can't play someone invoking their...
But he did take the stand, in which case it's not only available to discuss, but the answer is the one that Judge Easterbrook said.
But
why did you tell us that in the beginning?
They didn't... They played the tape in their case in chief, though, which...
I understand that.
Which
but
both...
why isn't it appropriate after he testifies to say, in either to him in cross-examination or jury, why didn't he tell us that in the beginning?
It would be appropriate. If the state had not introduced the statement in its case in chief and then Smothers took the stand, they would clearly be permitted to impeach him, even on invocations of the right to remain silent that occurred before.
Why is there any difference between direct and impeachment use of this evidence? The one thing we know from the whole Doyle sequence is the Supreme Court says there's no difference between direct and impeachment use. So why should there be any difference now? Or alternatively, you can ask, even if you think there should be a direct versus impeachment difference, how could we create that difference on collateral review? 2254 D1 says we can only implement decisions of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has never drawn a direct versus impeachment difference in the Doyle sequence.
Well, two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is we do say that the post-Miranda claim is the more direct basis for affirmance. But in terms of the pre-Miranda invocation of the right to remain silent, it should be noted that there was a state and a federal basis for Smothers' counsel to object to this usage. And the state has never disputed our citation of the state law basis. In other words, under state law, Smothers had a right to prevent the court from to prevent the prosecution from using his invocation of his right to remain silent during their case in chief.
We're not here to enforce state law.
Well, it comes in, though, inherently under Strickland when you're asking whether counsel had a reasonable basis to object, because under Strickland, which is the governing federal standard, you have to look below that. You have to look to the prevailing professional norms. And as this court has recognized, when it's a claim that may have a state law basis, that means we have to then look and see if there was a state law basis, if there was a state law basis to object. And because under prevailing professional norms, a reasonably vigorous counsel, in the words of Strickland, would object on the state law basis. And here we've cited to the Finkel case, which was the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, indicating that that these pre-Miranda invocations of the right to remain silent are protected. And we've also cited to binding Wisconsin authority that if something happens before the defendant testifies, it's considered substantive. And so we would say on that basis, whether or not you look at the federal law, there was a basis for objection, and it was deficient to not object. But moving back to the post-Miranda issue, which we believe again is the most direct basis for affirming, there's just no way to reconcile the fact that Smothers was promised on March 23rd, 1996, that the state would not use his invocation of the right to remain silent against him, and then he follows that, does not make any post-Miranda statements to the police or the prosecutor, and then over 5 months later, in the closing argument, when the prosecutor argues, he knows that after 5+ months he can give a statement now, he can talk about the incident. It is certainly more than a hint that his failure to do so in that interim period is inconsistent with his trial testimony, which is why the district court had had no problem saying, and here's what the district court said, the court has little trouble concluding the prosecutor's remarks would naturally and necessarily be taken by the jury to be a reference to Smothers' post-arrest silence for purposes of impeachment. And given that Doyle specifically holds that you cannot impeach a defendant by reference to his post-Miranda silence, it is a black and white violation of that principle. And as we've explained on each of the bases the state has tried to distinguish Doyle, they just make it worse. The state points out that they didn't cross-examine him on it, but that just prevented him from giving a common sense explanation to the jury that I was relying on my Miranda rights. Instead, they reserved it for closing argument, where there was no chance for Smothers to rebut it, and his counsel made no objection and just sprung it on them in closing, where it would have the most strong effect on the jury. And in fact, the only way you can really reconcile the jury's result is that they did believe Smothers most of the way, but not all of the way. And the way they didn't believe him was in terms of whether the situation really escalated to the, quote, kill or be killed situation that the prosecutor said he had all this time to dream up by using his counsel and by using witness statements and so forth during a 5-plus-month period of silence where he wasn't giving any statements to the police. And if the court has no further questions for our position, I'd be happy to rely on our brief for the rest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Gaskin. Anything further, Mr. Weinstein?
I'd like to address the waiver aspect. Mr. Gaskin is pretty much correct that the state didn't address prejudice in the post-Miranda context, because the way the brief addressed the claim in the district court was only a claim that it was a violation of Doyle to refer to the 911 call. And he did address prejudice in that regard. And the district court, of course, addressed prejudice in both pre and post. So I don't think the district court ignored prejudice, and certainly to prevail, Mr. Smothers has to demonstrate both deficient performance and prejudice. On whether or not the prosecutor's argument had any effect on the jury vis-a-vis whether or not the amount of force was reasonable, there was really overwhelming evidence, in my view, to demonstrate that the amount of force was excessive, and that aspect of Mr. Smothers' testimony, even assuming that the testimony he gave went to everything, didn't depend on the prosecutor's argument. The most telling thing, I think, is that the medical examiner testified that the victim had defensive wounds on his hands and arms. And according to Mr. Smothers, he stabbed him, the fatal stab, while the victim was choking him. So, of course, if that were the case, I don't know when he could have gotten defensive wounds on his hands and arms, because he began choking him in the truck, and according to Mr. Smothers, continued to choke him the entire time until the fatal stab. The other thing is there were 5 what the medical examiner referred to as deep stab wounds in the victim. And lastly, the medical examiner testified that the blood alcohol level of the victim was so great that he would have difficulty standing and in making coordinated movements. And so I think it was much more likely that evidence persuaded the jury that even though Mr. Smothers was acting in self-defense, his belief in the amount of force necessary was unreasonable. And that was the result the jury came to. And it decided he was guilty of second degree. So it seems to me the prosecutor's argument, whether it was a violation of Doyle or not, just didn't have any effect at all on the trial.
Bingo.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weinstein. And Mr. Gaskin, we appreciate your willingness and that of Mayor Brown to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.